42 years ago, in 1976, in Denton, Texas, two men stood before an audience of 5,000 people for 4 nights, for 2 hours every night, to discuss the most important question in the world. Is there a God? Does God exist? One of these men at the time in 1976 was named Anthony Flew, and by virtually all accounts all over the world, he was recognized as the world's leading atheist. He had written a paper that to this day, after 5 or 6 decades that the paper had been written, is the most widely distributed atheistic philosophical paper ever written. The most studied, the most widely distributed, the most copied, the most looked at, passed out paper ever done on the topic. By all accounts, the man was the world's leading atheist. On the other side, there was a man by the name of Thomas B. Warren. Thomas B. Warren might be familiar to some of you. Some of you might have even had the privilege and the pleasure of listening to Brother Warren talk about subjects like this. And in a book that Anthony Flew wrote in his 80s, he said of all the people that he ever spoke to publicly in a live audience, in Denton, Texas, to 5,000 people every single night on the subject of the existence of God, was the biggest audience he ever addressed. Live audience. And so he was standing for the idea that there is no God. He was the champion of atheism. And on the other hand, Thomas B. Warren was standing for the idea that God exists. You know, ultimately, those are really the only two options. Either there is a God, or there's not a God. And we are assembled here this evening to, on an individual basis and as a corporate group, as we've joined together, to address that idea, can you know if God exists? Can you say there is a God, or can you say positively there is not a God? Which of those two ideas is correct? You've probably heard those ideas put together In very easy to understand language. You've probably, some of you have been listening to a statement like this for years. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God divided the light from the darkness, and the light he called day, the darkness he called night, an evening and a morning, day one. And subsequently, day two, God creates the expanse, the heavens, the firmament. Day three, the flowers, grass, and trees. Day four, sun, moon, and stars. Day five, birds and fish. Day six, animals and humans. Day seven, ceasing his creative activity. That's probably how many of you have been presented the idea of God. There is a God according to that scenario and that statement. You've read it from Genesis chapter 1. What you might not be as familiar with is the atheistic idea. The word atheist coming from the Greek, a meaning no, theos meaning God, a theos, atheistic, there is no God, a belief that God does not exist. It goes something like this. In the beginning was matter. And matter begot the amoeba. And the amoeba begot the worm. The worm begot the fish. The fish begot the amphibian. The amphibian begot the reptile. The reptile begot the lower mammal. The lower mammal begot the lemur. The lemur begot the monkey. The monkey begot the man who imagined God. This is the genealogy of man. The idea of atheism suggests that there is nothing supernatural. There's no soul. There's no spirit. There is no creator outside of nature or above nature, super nature. There is nothing more than matter. Matter is all that there is. all that there was or all that there ever will be according to the atheistic idea. And we've come to consider which of those two ideas is right, the idea that there is no God, the idea that there is a God. Now, what you've been told, I would suggest, in many of the media outlets and many of the more scholarly circles, is that one of those ideas is a scientific idea and the other is not. What you have been told most likely is that that idea of atheism, that idea of materialism, the idea that you have to touch, see, taste, or smell everything that exists, that that's a scientific idea. And they suggest to us that it's scientific because you can study it, because you can do experiments on it, because you can probe it with your five senses. And then we are told that that idea of a supernatural God just simply isn't scientific and really shouldn't be considered in any intellectual discussions. We're told that that idea that there's a being that's outside of nature, you just can't study that being. You can't do experiments on that being. How much does God weigh? How tall is God? Well, if you can't answer questions like that, according to some, then you shouldn't even be having a discussion about the entity. And so what we're told is that idea of God is an idea that's based on faith, and that idea of atheism, no God, is one that's based on science. Now, the fact of the matter is, nothing could be further from the truth. And what we're going to do this evening is we're going to take the scientific ideas and the scientific laws, and we're going to apply them to both of those two ideas, no God and the idea that there is a God, and we're going to see which of those two ideas actually is scientific. And I think you might be surprised at the outcome if you have been listening to certain sectors of our country and even the world. Now, let's dive into that. You understand what a scientific law is. I think most all of us, we understand scientific laws. Scientific laws, they're called scientific laws for a reason. They're called scientific laws because there's never been an exception. Never once. If there ever were a single exception, guess what you would not have anymore in that area? You wouldn't have a law, because there would be an exception. So if I were to drop this key, I stopped at the rental place up at Houston Airport, rented a car, got a little Altima out there. They gave me one of these fancy keys that it's not even a key. You know, I mean, you get it. You don't even have to put it in the key thing. You just press the little button. It's one of the first cars like that I've driven, pretty snazzy. Now, I've got this little key fob, you could say. If I drop it, which way is it going? Well, you don't know what's going down. I mean, could it go up? Well, no, of course you do. Of course you know that it's going down. And why is it going down? Because the law of gravity says that things are accelerating toward the center of the earth at 9.8 meters per second squared, whether you like it or not. Right? Now, that law of gravity works if we are here in Port Lavaca, Texas. Works if we're at the Nashville airport. It works if we're in Hawaii. It works if we're in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. Doesn't matter where we are, that law of gravity is going to work. Now, let's say you don't like the law of gravity, and you think that gravity just isn't your friend, and it's not doing you any favors, and so you'd like to change the law of gravity. And so let's hypothetically say that we get together, and we say, guys, you've been liking the law of gravity. Well, me neither. You know, it just kind of pulls you down. The gravity just kind of brings you down a little bit. And so let's change it. Let's get together, and let's vote on it. And so we gather together here, and we've got 100 people, and we say, all right, 100 people probably not going to get the vote. Let's assemble 1 million of the most brilliant scientists in the whole world. They got the top degrees, top credentials, terminal degrees in every branch of the sciences. And let's ask them to vote on it. And so we say, all those in favor of changing the law of gravity say aye. And so we all raise our hands, and all 1 million of the most brilliant scientists in the world, they raise their hands. And so we've got 1,100,000 people who have all just voted to change the law of gravity. We say, all right. You know, I'm excited about this because when I get out of bed in the mornings, you know what I wish would happen? Yeah, I've been having to put my feet on the floor, but now I'll just get to slide out of my bed and shove off and float over to my dresser. Won't that be exciting? I mean, I'm not even going to have to step on the floor because we just changed the law of gravity. We just voted. All right, I just need a volunteer to step off a 20-story building to prove we've changed it. Any takers? No, we don't have any takers, do we? Because it doesn't matter if we have a million. Well, maybe a million's not enough. What about two? 2 million. And maybe 2 million. What about 2 billion? Now, right now, they suggest to us that there are, what, 7.54 billion people in the world. Let's get them all and vote. That'd be something, wouldn't it? Everyone votes to change the law of gravity, and it'd still be a law, wouldn't it? It doesn't matter who votes on it. It's not like a legislative law. It's not like we change it. It's a law because that's how nature works. And doesn't matter if you like it, doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter how credentialed or educated you are, guess what? Gravity's going to work for you or against you, depending on what side you put yourself on, whether you like it or not. So we've got the idea of a scientific law. Now let's take that idea of a scientific law and ask ourselves the simplest question in all of science. We all are fairly efficient scientists, whether we know it or not. The most fundamental question of science is simply this: what caused that? That's the question that's used in every scientific experiment ever done. What caused that? Now, when we say what caused that, and virtually every experiment, well, every experiment is trying to get down to the bottom of that one question, what are we dealing with? Well, we're dealing with the most fundamental law of science that any human being understands and knows, and that's the law of cause and effect. And here's what the law of cause and effect says. You, on a regular basis, use it every single day, multiple times, probably thousands, even though we don't process it like, oh, I just used the law of cause and effect to make sure that I didn't get run over by a truck. We don't do that on a regular basis, but that's what happens in our life. Here's what the law of cause and effect says, very simply. It says, for every material effect you see, there is a cause that came before it or happened at the exact same time and was greater than it. Okay? For every material effect you see, there is a cause that came before it and was greater than it. Now, you understand that perfectly, and I'll illustrate it for you. Suppose, now this, there again, this is hypothetical, but work with me. Suppose that I am standing up here, and you guys are listening so intently, you're not thinking about the show you're going to watch after this lesson tonight. You're not thinking about that you didn't get much to eat and you're really kind of hungry and you're hoping you stop at Whataburger on the way home. You're not thinking about anything like that. You're listening intently to everything that I say. Like it's hypothetical. I know it is hypothetical, but work with me. You're listening intently to everything I say. And all of a sudden, this songbook launches across this room at 95 miles an hour, crashes into the clock, blows it up, smashes into, 892 pages? Your eyes get as big as saucers. You turn to me and you say, Kyle, what caused that? It's a good question. Now, suppose with a straight face, I sincerely answer your question by saying nothing. Sometimes songbooks spontaneously shoot across rooms at 95 miles an hour. They don't need an antecedent cause. What? You're laughing. What's funny about that? Well, of course, nobody in their right mind would answer that a songbook launches itself across a room with no cause. Why? Because it's a material effect. The most fundamental law of science is that every material effect has a cause that came before and that was greater than it. Now, hold that thought. And let's move to the atheistic idea. Here's what we are told. Some 13.82 billion years ago, a tiny singularity that was 10 to the negative centimeters across, so small that you couldn't even see it with the unaided eye, you would need a microscope, that tiny singularity exploded in something called the Big Bang. And that big explosion sent everything in the universe out like a balloon. When it blew up, actually it was only, supposedly only hydrogen atoms, but those hydrogen atoms somehow were moving faster than the speed of light for a certain period of time called inflation, and then they started forming stars, and those stars started cooking and exploding, and they formed all the other elements, and somehow along the way, a star, our sun, formed from all of that leftover space debris, and then the gravitational pull of our sun caused dust to start to coalesce into a planet around the sun, forming the Earth about 5 billion years ago. Now here's the challenge, however. In the atheistic scenario, 13.82 billion years ago, a tiny singularity. Well, you ask, okay, that a tiny ball of stuff, to put it on layman's terms, a tiny ball of stuff, where did the tiny ball of stuff come from? You see, the law of cause and effect applies to everything that's material. That tiny ball of stuff is a material effect. And so we need to ask the question, what's the cause of the material effect of the tiny ball of stuff? Now, if I were to say to you with a straight face, hey guys, this songbook just spontaneously shot across the room with no cause, you would chuckle and laugh and think, okay, you're joking, but what if I said, no, seriously? This songbook really did not have a cause. It just shot across this auditorium. Well, then you start to think, well, hold on just a second. Yeah, I don't care what that little biography that Brother Shan read says about this guy standing up in front of us. If he's going to try to tell me with a straight face that songbooks just spontaneously shoot across rooms with no cause, he's one brick shy of a load. His elevator's not going all the way up. He's not the sharpest tool in the shed. Something's missing there. Okay, and that would be right. Something would be missing there, but let me then explain to you the situation that the atheist finds himself in. You see, if matter is all there is, all there was, all there ever will be, and if there's nothing supernatural, then you have a material effect, that original ball of stuff, and you've got to have a cause for it if you're going to be scientific. But if matter is all there is, and all there was, and all there ever will be, then what caused that? And so, I'll explain to you what the brightest atheistic minds have put forward as an explanation to where that original ball of stuff supposedly came from. There's a man by the name of Stephen Hawking. You probably are familiar with Stephen Hawking. I say that you're familiar with Stephen Hawking because he's probably the most famous theoretical physicist in the world. Now, when I say the most famous theoretical physicist in the world, how many other ones do you know? Not only is he the most famous theoretical physicist in the world, he's probably the only one that you know. And one of the reasons he's the only one that you know is because he has taken some theoretical physics ideas and put them into the popular arena. He has been featured on several different shows. History Channel has him on the Curiosity Show. He subsequently has passed away, but did have him on the Curiosity Show. Very, very famous. He had Lou Gehrig's disease. In fact, one of the most brilliant minds, arguably the most brilliant mind of the past 10, 20 years or so, had Lou Gehrig's disease. If I understand it right, he had a chair rigged up for him so that he could control his chair, he could control his computer and everything from about an inch of muscle tissue on his face. And he would deliver lectures, he would answer questions from the audience, they would ask him a question, and he was able to manipulate that computer to where he could pull up preset paragraphs that he had written to answer those kinds of questions. Just very, very famous. And he wrote several books about this idea of how you could come up with a ball of stuff without a God. And in one of his books, he wrote it originally and left the idea open that there could be a God because this was such a difficult problem. And his atheistic colleague said, hold on just a second. No, that's not going to work. You've got to write another book and explain that there is no room for God, and we know that there's not, and we can show that you don't need a God. And so he did. He wrote a book called The Grand Design. And in The Grand Design, he put forth, now listen to me, he put forth being possibly one of the, if not the most brilliant minds in the world for the last 20 years. He put forth the best explanation that atheism can arrive at to explain that original ball of stuff that they suggest was there. And here's what he said. He said, when you start looking at space and stars and black holes and things like that, he said, you've got stars, and they can't spontaneously generate from nothing. They've got to have a cause. He said, you've got black holes, and they can't spontaneously generate from nothing. They've got to have a cause. And then you've got universes, he said. And even though stars can't pop into existence from nothing, and black holes can't pop into existence from nothing, and all these other entities cannot pop into existence from nothing, when asked, what about universes? He said, oh, but they can. And you said, well, why would you say they can? Well, if you don't say they can, then you need it. You need something supernatural. You need something that doesn't behave in the same way that nature behaves. Folks, if I were to stand up here and tell you that this songbook spontaneously shot itself across the room going 95 miles an hour, and I'm not joking, we've got a real issue, don't we? Now what if I were to stand up here and tell you that our entire universe spontaneously popped into existence from nothing with a straight face? You see, that's a problem, isn't it? Because it's not scientific. And here's what we know. We know that material stuff can't do that. See, the challenge that the atheist has is we've studied matter, and the law of cause and effect applies to everything material that there is, and so you've got this singularity, and the atheist wants to say that it's matter, but then they want to say, but it doesn't behave like matter. It's got to do something non-material. It's got to act like more than matter. It's got to not have the laws of matter apply to it. It's got to be super matter. It's got to be what? Yeah, it's got to be supernatured. You see where you're going? Well, yeah, they want something to fix their problem, but if matter's all they get, then the law of cause and effect has got to apply to it. And if you're an atheist, matter is all you get. But you need something, super matter, to get you a universe. And so we then suggest, well, let's take our real definition of science. The real definition of science never has been, never will be, confine your answers to only matter. That's not the real definition of science. The real definition of science is the search for knowledge. Now, if you've got a universe and matter can't give it to you, where then, if you're following the scientific pursuit, do you have to go? Well, you got to go to something more than matter. And we've got that. A supernatural God. And so the atheist then, when we say, hey, what caused that ball of stuff? They say, well, we can't say, we're going to say nothing, but what caused God? Good question. What did cause God? Now, let's rewind a little bit and look at the definition of law of cause and effect. Where did we formulate the law of cause and effect? Here in the material world. Law of cause and effect applies to everything material. In fact, we said that every time you have a material effect, you have to have a cause that came before it was greater than it. Now, we use the law of cause and effect on the material world because we can study that, but has anybody ever suggested, at least in a serious discussion between theism and atheism, that God is matter? No, God is a spirit. He is not matter. He is super matter, supernatural. And so you've got to, in order to have an answer for this universe, you've got to have something that doesn't behave like matter, and you can't say, we're going to say matter is all you got, but then we're going to say matter doesn't behave like matter. Can't do that. And so you've got matter, and matter has to have a cause, and you need an uncaused cause. You need something eternal. And so you go to Romans chapter 1, verse 20, and you listen to Paul when he stated, for since the beginning of creation, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things which are made, even his eternal power. Now, you know, you don't need a Bible to know that there's eternal God. You don't need any revelation other than this creation to know that there is a being that has always been here and matter is not it. So the first thing you need is a cause, and that cause has to be non-matter. And atheism fails in the first scientific discussion that it starts, because the law of cause and effect is the most fundamental scientific law in the world, and atheism fails to pass that test. But the second aspect of the law of cause and effect says this. Now work with me. There again, hypothetical. You are all listening intently. We are back to our songbook that is on the edge of this particular table. You're there, you're paying close attention. All of a sudden, the songbook poof, poof, shoots across the room, 95 miles an hour. Your eyes get as big as sausage. You turn to me and you say, Kyle, what caused that? Now, this time, I do not posit the ridiculous idea that songbooks spontaneously shoot themselves across rooms. That's ridiculous. We know better than that. I say, while you were listening so intently to me, you did not notice the speck of dust that moved by the air from off of this little cloth onto the edge of the songbook. Boom! It hit the edge of that songbook and catapulted it 95 miles an hour, that speck of dust. That's what did it. Big enough cause? It's not big enough, is it? Now, remember the law of cause and effect. Here's what it says. For every material effect you see, our universe is a material effect, has to have a cause that came before it, or was it at the same time as it, and it has to be greater than it. Now, there's a reason you don't think that a speck of dust launched this songbook going 95 miles an hour. What's the problem with it? Not big enough. How big do we need our cause to be? That's a good question. Let me just give you a little fraction of how large our universe is. Our universe at the present, several years ago, when I say several hundred years ago, our universe, the people who were looking out into the night sky were trying to literally count the stars. And some of them did. Tycho Brahe counted 777 and thought he nailed it at 777. Johannes Kepler came along about 25 years after Brahe and said, Tycho, no, not 777. Actually, it's closer to, I think Kepler said like 1,053, somewhere around there. It's quite a bit of stars. My son, when he was little, I've got a 15-year-old son now, when he was small, on Saturday mornings, he would get up and do things before my wife and I would get up. He would get up like 6, 6:30, whatever. We'd sleep in until 7:30, 8, whatever. So he'd get up and just do stuff. You know, sometimes he'd build Lincoln Logs. One morning he got up and we said, Drew, what'd you do today? He said, I counted. I said, what'd you count to? He said, 3,000. You ever got up on a Saturday morning, light streaming through your blinds, and you think, today I think I'll just count to 3,000. Well, I have never. That's never been an option for me. If I get up on a Saturday morning and my only option is counting to 3,000, I'm going back to sleep. I guarantee you that. Now, subsequently, as I had told that story, and another little kid, he was about 9 years old, I think, came up to me. It was a girl. She came up to me, and she said, well, I do that. I was like, what? I get up and count sometimes. Okay. Hey, maybe some of you are closet counters. I mean, you just get up, and one Saturday a month, you get up and start counting. I see counts to 3,000. Now, I don't know how long it's going to take you to count to 3,000. Let's say you start right now. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. Every single one of those numbers, as fast as you can count them, every single one of those numbers represents a star. Okay? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Every one of those represents a star. Obviously, 777, a little low. 1,053, a little low. About, I'm going to say 5 years ago, they estimated that in our one galaxy, you know what galaxy we live in? Yeah, you know why you know the Milky Way galaxy? Because it's named after a candy bar. I mean, we got the candy bar galaxy. Everybody else got, well, not everybody else, all the other stars and stuff got like Andromeda. Somebody else got like galaxy GX3062. I mean, nobody got Snickers galaxy. Well, we got the best one, Milky Way galaxy. Okay, in our Milky Way galaxy, tongue in cheek, but in our Milky Way galaxy, about 5 years ago, they estimated that there are 100 billion stars. Okay? Now, let's work through this together. 100 billion. If you counted to 10,000 every morning, and every one of those numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, every one represented an actual star, and you counted to 10,000 every morning. Now, let's put this in a little more perspective. Our sun is a middle-sized star. It's not overly big. It's not tiny. It's not big. It's just right in the middle. You can take 1 million Earths and put 1 million Earths inside the sun. Okay, so we've got the sun. We take 1 million Earths. You can put 1 million Earths inside the sun. Some of the stars are 1,400 times bigger than the sun. So you could put 1 million Earths in our sun, then you could take 1,400 suns and put them in some of the bigger stars, okay? So some of the bigger stars will hold 1,400 million Earths. Okay, that's how big they are. Now, 100 billion stars, some of them 1,400 times bigger than the sun. Count to 10,000 every day. How long is it going to take you to count to 100 billion? Well, it's not going to take you 10 years. It's not going to take you 100 years. It's not going to take you 1,000 years. It's not going to take you 10,000 years. Folks, if you count to 10,000 every day, And every one of those represents a star, and some of those stars are a million times the size of the Earth, and some of those stars are 1,400 million times the size of the Earth. It's going to take you 27,000 years to count to 100 billion. Now, I said that was 5 years ago. 5 years ago, they said, hey, probably about 100 billion stars. No, actually, we got that wrong. The equipment and the instruments that we're using to look out into our Milky Way galaxy, we didn't count for space dust. There's a whole lot of dust out there. We didn't really calculate for space dust. We think there are 3 to 4 times as many as 100 billion. Folks, they think there are 400 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Now, next question, to just put it in perspective. How big our universe is. How many galaxies are there? Okay, there are potentially 400 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. So we took all those stars, we put them in this little galaxy. Now, how many galaxies we got? Oh, they estimate that there are... Anybody want to take a shot at it? That's right, 100 billion galaxies. Well, they did estimate that there are 100 billion galaxies, and they estimated that if this universe, if you could theoretically go from one side to the other. Now, I'm not really just trying to throw all this stuff at you. There really is a point to this, so stick with me. We're going to get to the end of this here. But let's say that this was the edge of the universe, and you could travel the speed of light, 186,000 miles a second, approximately, 186,302, right at it. So you're right here. Every second, you can go 7 times around the Earth's equator in a second. One. That's 7 times. That's how fast light travels. All right, so you start on this end of the universe, and you're wanting to go to the other end traveling the speed of light. 186,000 miles a second. Do you know how long it's going to take you to go from one end of the universe to the other one traveling the speed of light? Not 10,000 years, not 50,000 years. Well, up until about, there again, 5 years ago, they said it's right at about 46 billion light years across. So, if you could start over there and you could travel the speed of light, it would take you 46 billion years to get from one edge of the universe to the other one. I said about 5 years ago, here's the problem with it. They said, oh, you know what, now, we think now it's actually more like 95 billion. And then at the end of this particular article that I was reading, they said, and some Oxford scientists think it could be, now catch this. I mean, they said this glibly in a single sentence at the end of a paragraph in the middle of their article. 96 billion light years, meaning if you could travel the speed of light, taking 96 billion years. And then they said at the end of that, but some Oxford scientists think it might be 250 times that. 250 times 96 billion. Now, let's go back to our law of cause and effect that says you have to have a cause that came before the effect and was what? And you don't think the dust shot this songbook across because it's not big enough. Now, we've got a universe that is at least 96 billion light years across, and it's full of 100 billion galaxies at least, and some of those galaxies got 400 billion stars, and some of those stars are 1,400 times the size of the sun, and the sun will hold a million Earths. Now, what are we told brought that into existence? A tiny singularity that was 10 to the negative 26 centimeters across. You couldn't even see it with the unaided eye. That's not a scientific idea. You know why? Because it's not big enough. Now, what would be? A supernatural God gives you a cause. And then not only is that supernatural God eternal, so it gives you a cause for everything that you see, but even his eternal power and Godhead. You see, you don't have to have a Bible verse 1 to know that whatever created this universe is bigger than the universe and had to be all powerful. In fact, I'm not using this to prove the point, just to make the point. If you were to go to Psalm 19, verses 1 through 3, you would read, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utters speech. Night unto night utters knowledge." There is no place, no language where their voice is not heard. And here's what that's saying. Human beings can look at the created order. They can look into the night sky and they can see all of those stars and they can realize the Creator had to be bigger. Eternal and all-powerful. Now, atheism cannot answer how a universe as big as ours came into existence. It just can't do it. Theism, the idea that there is a God, answers it perfectly. Now, when you tack on to that, not only does our universe exhibit something that had to have an eternal cause and had to have a cause that was all-powerful, but there's one other aspect of our universe that adds to what you can know about the Creator, and that's the fact that our universe works perfectly. Now, when I say works perfectly, that's the most grotesque understatement of any century when it's ever been stated. Works perfectly is so fundamentally undershooting what our universe actually does. I see even people who don't believe in God, they say, "We don't understand it. We don't know how it works. But it looks like our Earth is a Goldilocks planet." You know what a Goldilocks planet is? You remember Goldilocks, don't you? That three bears, Goldilocks and three bears. Three bears, you know, they're at their house and they're eating porridge. Yeah, that's the first problem right there, in my opinion. I've never eaten porridge myself, but you know, my mom, she does a lot of things really, really, really well. Oatmeal at our house was probably the closest thing to porridge that I'll ever get. And oatmeal at my, you know, it didn't come in these little fancy single serving paper pre-sweetened dried fruit. No, that wasn't oatmeal at my house. My oatmeal at my house, I remember Mom would make it in a big pan. Like, and she would put a spoon down in there. And I remember it making, when she would scoop it up, that sound, you know. And it would come out in the shape of the pan. And I would think, something is wrong with breakfast food that is shaped like a pan. And I don't know if your house was like mine, but then we would pour as much sugar and butter and then milk on top of it as we could, so we didn't really taste any oatmeal as it was going down. Just slightly. But I always thought, look, if you could feed it to the horse, if I don't eat it, then something's wrong with my breakfast meal. That's all. So the bears, they're eating porridge, and I can see why they left early. And they leave early to allegedly let it cool off, right? So Goldilocks comes in and she tries Daddy Bear's porridge and it's too hot. Mama Bear's is too cold. Baby Bear's, remember? Just right. And then she goes into the living room. Daddy Bear's chair's too hard. Mama Bear's chair's too soft. Baby Bear? Just right. She goes up to the beds. Daddy Bear's too lumpy. Mama Bear's too soft. Baby Bear's? Just right. So people who don't believe in God have come to our universe and specifically our planet and they say, we don't know what the deal is. It looks like it's all just right. Like the atmosphere surrounding the planet Earth is composed of the perfect percentages of the right gases so that people can breathe, but the atmosphere doesn't spontaneously set on fire. There's just the right amount of oxygen, it right at about 21%, but not more. So oxygen is very flammable and it would catch on fire if it was much more. We don't understand it. It looks just right for people to breathe. We don't understand it. It looks just right for the various aspects of where it's positioned around the sun, how it's 93 million miles from the sun on average, and how the Earth veers from a straight line only 1/9 of an inch every 18.5 miles or so. And if it was 1/10 of an inch, then it would get so far out that everything would freeze to death. But if it was 1/8 of an inch, then it would get so close at times, then everything would incinerate and burn up and life as we know it wouldn't exist. How is it that it's just exactly 1/9 of an inch every 18.5 miles? It looks just right. You see, and you go to the other principle for every house is built by someone. What's that statement mean? It means when you see design, you know that someone intelligent designed that. You know, there's a big difference between a pile of bricks and a house. And when you see a pile of bricks, you think, oh, that could have been dropped off in a truck. When you see a house, you think someone intelligent had to put a mind to work to put those things together to work as they do. And so back to Antony Flew. Antony Flew was there debating Thomas B. Warren in 1976 in Denton, Texas. And Dr. Flew started with this idea of design. It's a very simple idea. It was illustrated years and years ago when a man used the simple illustration that if you went out into the woods and you look down on the woods floor and you pick up a watch and you see that that watch has hands and you see it has gears and you see it has springs and everything's working together. William Paley put forth this idea about the watchmaker. Well, you look at that watch and you know something, whether you see the person or not, you see the intelligent design or not, you know that that watch has an intelligent design. It's the law of design. You see, the law of design simply says that anytime you see something that has design, functional complexity, pieces put together for a specific reason to bring about a purpose, then that has a designer. And so Thomas Warren, I think it was about the third night of that debate, was talking to the recognized leading atheist in the world. And he said, Dr. Flew, just want to ask you a question. This was back when they had those overheads with those little clear pieces of plastic. They put them on that overhead projector that had that light shine through them. Some of you have never seen one of those. Don't worry, it's okay. There used to be rotary phones and stuff like that too. It's a little overhead, just had a line drawing. It's all he had of a prosthetic limb, an artificial hand. And he said, Dr. Flew, did this artificial hand have a designer? It's a good question. You know, prosthetics have come a long way since 1976, a long way. In fact, we've written several articles about prosthesis on our Apologetics Press website, one about a 26-year-old Marine who got a prosthetic limb. 10 pounds it weighed, cost $4 million to make. That's not really even counting the research and design that went into it. $4 million, 10-pound metal alloy arm that they attached to her shoulder, and they were literally able to pull nerves from her shoulder and hooked them to wires that connected to motors on the fingers of the prosthetic limb so that she literally could think about moving her pinky. They miswired it. And so they had to train her so that when she thought about moving her pinky, she could literally move her pinky. They said, this is amazing. Dr. Kuchen, the man in charge of the research and development of this, he said, first time we've ever seen this. He said, she can take a jar of spaghetti with one hand, she can take a spoon with the other, and she can scrape out the remaining spaghetti sauce. We've never seen anything like it. Said she can fold a pair of pants without using a hard surface. This is advanced prosthetic technology. Nobody's ever seen it. He said, but it's clumsy. It's the most advanced prosthetic technology in the world, but it's clumsy compared to what? Oh, yeah. So, Dr. Flew, did this prosthetic hand have a designer? What's Dr. Flew have to say? You can't say songbooks, shoot yourself across the room. You can't and keep a straight face and anybody take you serious. You can't do it. He has to say, yeah, it has a designer. He's got to. That's the only scientific answer available. Okay, so then Thomas Warren puts a picture of a human hand up. Plain old human hand. If some of you think that your left hand is clumsy, if you ever try to throw left-handed if you're not left-handed or right-handed if you are, and you think, that just doesn't even feel right, it doesn't work right, compared to a prosthesis, you'll see clumsy. Dr. Flew says, yes, that prosthetic hand has a designer. So Dr. Flew then sees Dr. Warren put up a picture of a human hand, and Dr. Warren says to Dr. Flew, Dr. Flew, did this hand have a designer? Take a hammer, accidentally smash the finger of a $4 million metal alloy hand. What do you have? A smash finger and a pretty big bill to fix it, don't you? Well, let it sit 6 weeks, see what happens. Is it going to fix itself? take a hammer, accidentally smashed your finger. What happened? Oh, it just so happens that your body has a cascade of chemical enzymes in it that immediately start to eat away the little pieces of bone that are no longer going to be used to improve and regenerate your finger. Now, let that sink in. Your body has a chemical cascade of enzymes that eats bone. What if that gets out of control? You can wake up the next morning like, wow, sorry guys, I guess... because my body just ate all the bone in my... That could happen, but it doesn't. Why? Because your body is so well designed that it only eats the little chips of bone that it knows it's not going to use anymore. And then the ones that it is going to use, it puts them back together. And although it might be a little bit more crooked or a little bit more bulky where your finger heals, lots of times it's stronger in that place than it was before you broke it. Take a knife, cut a wire on one of those motors that was connecting to the prosthetic limb, and guess what happens? Stays cut till somebody intelligent comes and fixes it. You take a knife and you cut a capillary, a vein, an artery on your arm, what happens? You're not even thinking about it. It's not like you think, oh, I cut my arm, I need to start sending the 21 necessary chemicals to get down there to start clotting my blood. Your body does it itself. And it's very specific about that because if blood clots got out of control, they could kill you, but your body makes sure that it clots the blood only where it needs to clot it, and you cut your finger, and within literally seconds, your body starts to repair itself. It doesn't take weeks. It takes minutes. So Dr. Flew was then asked, did this hand have a designer? Now, folks, if you're going to be honest, what do you have to say? Honesty and true search for knowledge forces you to a single conclusion. But he's the world's leading atheist. He can't very well in front of the world and 5,000 people say it had a designer because then he's no longer the world's leading atheist. He just said the prosthetic limb has one. Dr. Flew, does this hand have a designer? You know what he says? No. Dr. Warren said, how'd it get there? And Flew said, it just grew there. It just shot across the room going 95 miles an hour. That just happens sometimes. No, it doesn't. Things like that don't just grow there. That was in 1976. In 2006, Anthony Flew wrote a new book. There is No God. That was the title of the book that he wrote in 2006. After 50 years of hard-nosed atheism, being the world's leading atheist, he writes a book, There is No God. The no is marked out with a big A over the top of it, and there's a subtitle. There is a God, how the world's most notorious atheist became a believer. And after 30 years of atheism, he said, in my life, my mode of operation has always been to follow the evidence where it leads. He said, in the past, I thought the evidence led to atheism. I was wrong. He said, one of the primary arguments that convinced him that there's a God is the DNA and the design of the language behind the human body structure and ultimately all life structure. And he said, there is no possible way you can be honest and look at the coded language of DNA and say there is not an intelligent, supernatural, all-powerful designer. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It's the most scientific statement ever uttered. Now let me tell you the tragedy of Anthony Flew's life. He was, I think, about 82 when he wrote his book, There Is a God. People like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, the new atheist, basically said he was hedging his bets. Said he was about to die, and he just wanted to throw a nod over toward God in case there was something on the other side. Said he was getting senile with cutting, amazingly accurate, logical argument. He demolished every single one of their statements. Everything that Richard Dawkins said, Flew said, here's why that's wrong. Bang, 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 bang. No senility. So then they ask him, okay, so you believe in God now? Great. Which one? He said, they said, we know that you've said that there's an all-powerful, supernatural, intelligent creator, but which one is it? Are you going to adhere to a religion? And here's what he said. This is why I find his conclusion and ultimately the ending of his life so tragic. He said, well, I've come a long way. I was an atheist, now I'm a believer. He said, and I think if I looked into Christianity and studied it, I think I would probably end up being a Christian because what I can tell of all of the religions, it's the most philosophically sound. But I'm not going any further. I'm going to leave that to other experts, and I'm just going to remain a creationist. He stopped at God. But he didn't take the next step to God in the flesh, Jesus Christ. You know, James wrote about that, didn't he? When he said, you believe in one God? You do well. Even the demons believe. And A. Trimble, do you know I have been working at Apologetics Press for going on 20 years? And there is a reason that I stand up and deliver lectures and talks on the existence of God and have been for the last 20 years or so. So I can then say, and that God took on human flesh and died for you. God doesn't want you to just say, hey, yeah, I recognize you. I know you're there. And yes, I believe there's a creator. Because if that's as far as you go, you've done as good as the demons. What God has always wanted from his creatures is a loving relationship that is based on his sacrifice, taking care of your sins and your faithful obedience to him. That's what he's always asked. And when we look at the revealed natural world and we see God's eternal power and his Godhead, and we see that every house that's built is built by someone, but he who built all things is God, if we then don't say, God, what do you want me to do? We've missed the whole point, haven't we? Well, he's got something that he wants you to do. He wants you to respond in faithful obedience, to recognize that Jesus Christ, God in the flesh, his son, came and died on the cross and paid for every one of the sins that you'll ever do. If you will repent and be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins, he'll add you to the saved body of his creation. And one day, after this physical life is over, you'll get to enjoy the promise that Jesus Christ gave to his apostles when he said, you believe in God? Where's Jesus going with that? John 14, you believe in God? Okay. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it weren't so, I would have told you. I'm going to prepare a place for you. And if I go to prepare a place for you, then when I come again, I'm going to receive you to myself, that where I am, there you can be also. You get to come be with the Creator. If you're willing to repent and obey. We have an awesome Creator. It's exciting to think of what he's done. And it's exciting to think of what he can do in your life if you'll let him. If you need to respond to the Creator's invitation in any way, I hope you will tonight as we stand and as we sing.